HRN is offering complimentary business memberships to 50 Black, Indigenous, people of color-owned food businesses this summer. The deadline to apply is July 31st. Each business membership, a $500 value, is an advertising opportunity that will allow businesses disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 to connect with HRN's listening community and promote their work. To apply and review the terms and conditions, go to heritageradionetwork.org/BIZ.
This episode is brought to you by Vertera Dinnerware. Learn more at vertera.com. That's VERTERRA.com.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. I'm on my own this week. I'm your lone co-host, Ethan Frisch. Valerie is, doing something else more exciting than recording a podcast. I don't know what that could possibly be, but here we are. I have a guest this week who I'm really excited to introduce you to. Osiris Bellamy is the founder of Blondery, an amazing pastry chef and the creator of a brand that we're going to talk about. Osiris, thanks for joining me.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
So let's just start off with a little bit of background. Who are you and what is Blondery?
All right. So my name's Osiris. I make and ship blondies nationwide. I started my career at Bouchon Bakery in Yountville. While there, I worked my way up to a sous chef, and I stayed with Thomas Keller Restaurant Group for 3.5 years. While there, I staged at French Laundry, Per Se, Danielle, before transitioning into launching Blondery, which, the best blondies you'll ever have in your life.
So let's talk about that transition, because that's sort of what brings you to our show today. In other cases, we interview people who have completely changed careers. You know, Valerie was a lawyer and is now a baker. But in your case, we're going to talk about this transition sort of within food from working as a pastry chef or a baker in other people's businesses to then going off and doing it on your own. Where did that idea come from, and what were the very early steps, or how did you think through that process from the very beginning?
So I moved to New York about 5 years ago from the Bay Area. That's where I'm from. And I had always made blondies for my friends and family. And when I moved during the holiday season, they were texting me and emailing me, where are the blondies? So I started shipping them back to California. And eventually, there were a little more orders than I expected. So I decided to open a Squarespace website, very bare bones. It was supposed to just be for my family and friends. And I ended up selling over 500 orders in a 2-week time period. So wow. That's when I kind of was like, okay, this has to be a business. So I wouldn't say I took the business quite seriously right away, but I did start to build up my confidence in myself to run a company. And now here we are. We have four core flavors, which is our pecan and salted caramel. It has a salted caramel ganache, a little bit of pink Himalayan sea salt, some toasted pecans. It is so yummy. It's the one that started the business. And then we branched out to include cinnamon sugar, Brooklyn Blackout, and a birthday cake flavor. And then we also have seasonal flavors that rotate in throughout the year.
That's awesome. So maybe excuse like a kind of a dumb question, but what's the deal with blondies? Like why are blondies a thing? To me, they've always been, maybe you're going to hang up the phone. To me, they've always been sort of the not as good cousin to the brownie. So what's the deal with blondies?
No, that's true. I think that, what people ask me all the time, what's a blondie? I'm like, you've probably had it before, but you just didn't realize you were eating it. It's just something like the real story is that I love those pecan praline candies that you can get like in New Orleans, but they're like really a Southern candy. And I was chasing that flavor memory. So the pecan and salted caramel blondie is a nod to that candy. I started with just, you know, a chocolate chip cookie base, and then I tried to make it more cakey, and then I landed, oh, it's like, it's a brownie. So I started with a butterscotch base still to this day. So I boil butter and sugar. And then I added a salted caramel ganache. Actually, it was just a regular salted caramel sauce to start. And then I was like, let's take this up a notch. Let's make a ganache. And then the pink Himalayan sea salt, and then the toasted pecans, it just all came together and people loved it. So it was really just me chasing this food memory I had as a child of eating those pecan praline candies.
That's awesome. And do people ask you if you're going to make brownies, or have you ruled that out completely? Well, I guess you have blondies that are sort of brownies, right? There's the Brooklyn Blackout, so, am I remembering that correctly?
Correct, yeah. Correct. And people, I just posted on Instagram, because people will always call them brownies. And sometimes I feel like they're trolling me because the company's name is Blondery. And I'm like, why do you guys keep calling them brownies? Understandably so. Like you said, it's usually an afterthought at most bakeries. So we just took that, you know, that afterthought and made it something really special and something that you can ship to a friend and they'll be, you know, wowed when they open the box. But yeah, I think, it's important to note that brownies usually start with a cocoa base, and all of our blondies, even if they look brown, start with a butterscotch base.
And what does that do for the flavor? How does the butterscotch come through for somebody who hasn't tasted your products? How does the butterscotch come through across the different flavors?
Yeah, so I think for most of the flavors, you can really taste, because we use Pluger butter, so that's a European style of butter. You can really taste the butter, first of all. It has a higher fat content, so it's a very smooth mouthfeel. It's very moist and decadent. And then also the texture. So the texture is very chewy and noticeable. Once you taste one of the Blondery blondies, you'll see that it's not a brownie.
All right, got it. Let's talk a little bit about your entrepreneurial journey. Was this something that you had thought about doing for a long time? Was this a long time dream that you then found this kind of opportunity to pursue? Or did it really just happen accidentally?
No, this is something I've wanted for a long time. I grew up in a family of entrepreneurs, restaurateurs. My grandmother started a restaurant, I think, over 45 years ago now, that wow. Still stands to this day in the Bay Area.
Where
at the height, they had 12
restaurant?
Locations. We have two in Oakland and one in Berkeley.
What's it
so,
called?
So, Everton Jones Barbecue.
I love it.
Yeah, so I grew up in that. My mom is one of 8 children, so she had her location, which was in Hayward, and I grew up watching my mom and my aunts run a company, and my grandmother, obviously, as well. So it was something I wanted to be like them, you know? You grow up in that environment. They were working for themselves. They were always seemingly so happy, and they had this strong team, and I mean, at the height, it was like a enormous thing to see as a child. So I grew up wanting this, and you know, now I'm finally here. But I have tried other businesses, always pastry though. I've always baked, so I've been baking since I was 8 years old. So it was cupcakes, and then it was cakes, and now blondies.
Did you bake in the restaurants growing up, or did you? You must have spent time helping out the family in the restaurants, right?
Yeah. So I actually have never had a product sell in one of the restaurants, and
what?
My aunts. I know my aunts will tell you, and it's funny to say now that they felt like my prices were too high. And even, they even were at the time.
even at 8 years old when you were baking,
yes.
Whatever you were baking at 8 years old, they didn't want to pay whatever you were yes. charging.
They were always super gracious and would pay for it maybe once, but they were businesswomen. They were like, I'm not going to keep paying you unless you figure out your wholesale pricing. Cause I didn't want to sell it to them wholesale. I was like, well, there's a cupcake place down the street and they sell it for $4 to people. Why can't I sell it to you for $4? They're like, no, you have to sell it wholesale to us. I'm like, no, I want the $4. So yeah, me and my aunts will probably always go back and forth on my pricing, which I love.
Was the restaurant was it a fun place for you to be as a kid, or was it a chore to be there? How did you feel about being so kind of closely attached to the business growing up?
I felt like it was fun. I should also mention that my mom was kind of a double entrepreneur. So she, next door to the restaurant, she had her office, which was where she was a legal document assistant. So I saw her, you know, running her legal business and then also doing operations work for the restaurant. And I just felt like it was so cool. But it was also so normal. So, you know, there was times where my mom will tell you, like, I used to sit under her desk while she had meetings with clients and they wouldn't even know I was there. Like, I would just sit there and listen and not intentionally, but just, that's just what I did.
Yeah. There really does seem to be a theme. We've had several guests who are entrepreneurs themselves, but kind of grew up in an entrepreneurial environment. There seems to be a theme. I mean, my own story, my mother owned a toy store for most of my childhood. My grandmother owned a hardware store. So there is something, right? Like you pick up, I don't know what it is, whether it's like specific skills or something about the mindset that's required as a kid growing up in that environment. It just sets you up to either want to do it or to maybe not realize the risks involved because you've seen somebody doing it fairly successfully,
right.
Or at least to your eyes as a kid. What do you think about that? What's the relationship between your childhood growing up around entrepreneurs and then being an entrepreneur yourself? Did you feel like there were skills that you picked up or were there things that you sort of surprised you when you got to do it as an adult?
Well, I think both. So I know that my mom was very intentional about my professionalism. So she made me answer the phones and take messages. And that's when, you know, you had the message pads and work on my handwriting. And those were things I was doing from, you know, as soon as I could talk. But then, you know, how they ran the business back then is not how businesses necessarily run now. There's still some common denominators, but I feel like I'm a rookie. But I'm also a vet. So I've been around entrepreneurship for a while, but things changed so much with the internet and social media.
Yeah.
So it's a totally different ball game. And even I talk to my mom. I feel like she's like my business partner unofficially. But I talk to her about the things I'm doing now. She's like, we didn't do any of that. Like, what is PR? What is that? Like, she's just always like, we just serve good hot food and people came and New York Times wrote about us. That's how that worked back then.
So have you been able to help her with aspects of the business that she doesn't know that much about or ways to promote the business that she hadn't found?
So my mother removed herself from the business years ago. So she only does her law and legal business. She went to law school. So she's only doing that now, which she's very fulfilled and happy in. But no, I would love, I do share with my cousins who now run my grandmother's business. I do share what I can. But yeah, I would love to continue to pass along any information I have to anyone.
What are some of the highs and lows that you've had since starting the business? What are some of the points that really stand out either as a positive turning point or a time when you just weren't sure if you wanted to keep doing it?
Yeah, I would say that those times come pretty often. You know, there's a whole bunch of highs and lows. I can only speak to the most recent ones because I try to forget, you know, the I don't try to forget. I just do forget, you know, the other ones because new things come up. I would say most recently before the pandemic, I was questioning how was I going to continue to promote Blondery, but also work a full-time job. I was at Food Network working a full-time job. So Blondery's main source of income before the pandemic was through doing pop-ups, in-person pop-ups. And some of them were at WeWork or places that you could only come during the day. So I was having to kind of miss work in order to get Blondery off the ground. So this pandemic actually has, you know, transitioned our business a little bit into more virtual or digital bakery. But that was one of the lows, was that I felt like I was going to have to put Blondery on hold while I built my career at Food Network. Luckily, you know, Blondery has taken off and now I'm a full-time Blondery employee. But, you know, I still have things that keep me up at night about the business, and I'm always worried about shipping is a daily low because shipping in a pandemic has not been easy, especially with a perishable product. So I'm, you know, there's things that I have to deal with daily, but all, you know, people write me all the time. I just got my order and I love it and I've never tasted anything like this. Or they'll message me on Instagram, and that makes it all worth it. Cause really this is about, you know, making people happy and just providing something special that's outside of the norm.
Let's talk a little bit about your experience in kitchens, because you worked in some pretty high-end kitchens, some of the best in the country, if not the world. What was that like? Did you enjoy it? What were some of the, I guess the highs and lows of those experiences as well?
Yeah, so I enjoyed it. I learned a lot. However, it is not the most nurturing environment for a Black woman, because I was the only one. I was the only Black woman until I got to Bouchon in New York. Then there was one other Black person. Why does that matter? Because you have to fight against, you know, the unspoken prejudices that may happen. And then also, I don't think a lot of people realize that fine dining is kind of like the military. Whereas you have to be on point all the time. So that translates into all areas of your life, obviously, and that's the, you know, the benefit of working in that type of environment. But it was, you know, the saying that Black women have to work three times as hard to get half of what their white counterparts do. That's true in the kitchen too, especially in that type of environment. Like I said, I didn't see anyone as a sous chef that was Black, even women. There's not a lot of women in those kitchens.
Yeah. Do you think that changed the way that you thought about long-term career prospects, or how did that affect your motivation, either motivating you more or less in either direction?
Yeah. I mean, I walked away from fine dining heartbroken, I will say that, because I was told that there was no glass ceiling. Like, I could go to Per Se and be the pastry chef there, and I could do French Laundry. But every time, you know, I tried to push past and push myself, and I was asking my manager, what do I need to do to get better? How do I transfer? Are there any open positions? I'll take a pay cut. What do I have to do? And they hired other people. They just would simply do that. There was no explanation for it. It was just, you just have people work in this company for years before they get to French Laundry. But then they would hire, you know, an outside hire, have them train underneath me to transfer to Per Se or French Laundry. That happened twice. And I was just like, okay, so if I'm not good enough to go to these places, then maybe I then how am I training the person who's going to take that position? That doesn't make any sense. Yeah. So yeah, I felt that I wasn't good enough for a long time. And I think that's why it took me, you know, a while to start Blondery, because I had to build up my self-confidence again, to be very honest.
Do you think that racism and sexism exist in a different way in kitchens than they do in other kinds of workplaces, or in a way that's different from society at large?
I don't know, because I've only worked in food, so yeah. I can't really say, but I would say, just from what I've heard, you know, with other, my friends don't work in food, it's about the same, if not worse, because in kitchens, there's kind of no filter. There's corporate, but it's not as corporate as maybe working for a broadcasting agency or something like that. So it's, you know, the hair, what Black women's hair is still an issue in the kitchen, obviously. How you speak is still an issue. All of these things are still huge issues in the food industry.
Yeah, it's interesting, because there's this narrative around kitchens that it's a pure meritocracy, that if you're good at what you do, then your identity doesn't matter. And there are a lot of stories, you know, about people who aren't documented, or who don't speak English very well, or you know, have had to get over other hurdles and have been successful in kitchens. But I think those stories obscure the deeper seated problems, and especially when you talk about fine dining, I think like exactly like you said, the sort of military style of discipline and order, and the perception of that by higher ups who see certain people and versus other people and draw their own conclusions about that person's, I don't know, I would say like their fit in the environment. Were there ways that you felt like you changed your behavior, that you code switched in kitchens to change the way that other people
survive,
were perceiving you?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, code switching is about survival, right? Like, and I mean, that sucks that is what a lot of people, and not just Black people, Spanish or Latin people have to do that as well. So yeah, I definitely did code switch a lot. And eventually you get to the point where you don't even feel like yourself. I was depressed. I remember spending all my time on the weekends. I would just go to the Napa Library and read as many cookbooks as possible, because I just had to be the best. Like, I was just like, okay, I have to show them that I am the best. And I would bring new techniques to the CDC at Bouchon. They would use the techniques, but I still couldn't get transferred to French Laundry. It was just like, it was a very toxic environment for me. And moving to New York, I think, definitely helped. But my final straw was actually those stories of, you know, the dish cook who becomes the general manager. First of all, they're one in few, and people love those stories because it shows, oh, look, we did do this. We did promote them. Remember, we did that one. But why do we hit, like, and the common denominator is usually they did something extraordinary. And this goes back to, why do we as people of color have to be extraordinary, which I feel like we already are. Everyone already is in their own right. But why do we have to be this, you know, magnetic and huge presence for us to get recognized, when our counterparts don't have to do that? Like, they can just, you know, come in and do their work, and that's it. They don't have to do all of these like magic tricks and loops and hoops, and it's not ideal. And I think for Blondery, and I don't know if you're going to get to this and ask me this, but I want to say it now. For Blondery, I want to create an environment that bridges the gap between, because I went from culinary school, a short stint at Aramark, right into fine dining. And I want Blondery to be that in between, so that we can train people of color, or people who are notoriously marginalized in this industry, for that type of environment. So you already have, you know, the basic pastry skills or basic kitchen etiquette, so that's not a hurdle you have to jump over once you get into fine dining. Because I'm not saying that there's no value in working in fine dining. There's a lot of value in working there, but it's not a very nourishing environment for people of color.
Yeah.
Or women.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
This episode is brought to you by Vertera, impressively versatile, stylishly sustainable, environmentally disposable dinnerware from Fallen Leaves. Vertera is a mission-driven company focused on making environmentally responsible, single-use products. Founded in 2006 on the belief that every culinary creation deserves a beautiful, sustainably crafted foundation, Vertera reclaims earthly discards like fallen leaves and tree scraps to design elegant, disposable dinnerware that elevates the look of food presentation. In short, a beautiful disposable plate that can go with your food to a composting facility. The team from Vertera recently made a huge pivot with their factories and started producing masks, gloves, sanitizer, and other PPE that food businesses need to safely reopen. Learn more at Vertera.com. That's Vertera.com.
And we're back. We're joined this week by Osiris Bellamy, founder of Blondery. We were just talking before the break about some of her experiences working in fine dining. And Osiris, I'd really like to hear more about what you started to say before the break about how you plan to take the lessons that you learned in that environment and apply them as Blondery grows and as you hire more people. I know you've got big plans in that area. So tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, I'm working on building out a kitchen of my own. We've been renting kitchen space by the hour for the past 3 years. So it's time for us to get into our own kitchen. And I want it to be a place where people who have chosen food or pastry as their art form, that they can feel free to create and free to bring new ideas to the table, and they'll be compensated for it. Another issue, I think, with fine dining that's often not spoke about is compensation is usually pennies. You know, I was making, I'll be very honest and open, I was making $32,000 as a sous chef. And when I moved to New York, my salary stayed the same. And the cost of living is a lot different in New York than it is in Napa. So, I mean, it was a struggle. And I don't think that as an artist, you know, the starving artist like narrative, it doesn't have to be that way, especially in food. There are a lot of things that we can do to kind of supplement our team's income, which I'm looking into, and just making sure that people are able to, you know, not have to worry about their finances, but also come to work whole. So like mental health was a huge thing for me while I lived in Napa. You know, I went on walks, and I think that if I would have had access maybe to a counselor, then I could have worked through things a little quicker. But I was doing it all on my own, and I didn't even know what was going on. So, yeah, I hope to create all of this within Blondery to just, again, be a resource to people who are notoriously marginalized.
And how do you feel like that works, or what advice do you have? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is food is both notoriously exploitative, both in the culture, in the kitchen, and in undervaluing employees' work and intellectual contributions. But it's also a notoriously small margin industry. Costs are really high for space and ingredients and skilled labor. And so one of the excuses that often comes up is we don't provide those services, whether it's counseling or paying people a living wage or anything else, because we can't afford it, because customers won't pay for it. So, I mean, I think this ties into a bigger conversation that's been happening in the food industry for a long time, but has been accelerated by COVID, how do we build a better model for the food industry, and how do you plan to do that within your business?
Well, that's a big question, but
yeah, seriously. Sorry, I just threw it all at you.
Yeah, file this under questions I probably shouldn't answer, but will try my best to anyway. I believe that we just need to charge what we need to charge to be able to, one, sustain the business, but also make a profit. So if that means that Americans need to start paying more for their food, then that's what has to happen. I think that if food in America is very cheap, and it's very oftentimes very low quality, and that is, you know, we have a lot of issues with our health around that. And I mean, that's one thing. But also, restaurants, I know, are struggling, you know, with all of that's what's going on. But leaning into tech could save food, I believe. I'm not going to say there's no reason, because there's a lot of reasons why Grubhub, Uber Eats, Yelp, they're all in a way very predatory to restaurants. And I think that there are ways where we could have built our own systems where they didn't, you know, take 30% of your margin, where that you could essentially, you know, invest more in marketing. I think that restaurants typically don't invest a lot in marketing or PR. And that's kind of made it to where we're at this place where everyone's like at the table trying to get all the scraps they can. And then who suffers the most happens to be the employees, because we're cutting their wages or we're cutting their hours. And for me, I think I don't feel like the blondies are overpriced, but I've heard the comment before. But I want to be able to pay my employees a livable wage. That's why I'm priced where I'm at. That's the main reason why I'm priced where I'm at. And also on top of the fact that we use the best ingredients that you can buy. So,
yeah, I think this is a question. I mean, this is definitely a question that we get at Burlap and Barrel. I think this is a question that a lot of early stage food companies get. I think partially because we're just new, and so we haven't sort of proven ourselves yet. Because obviously there's no shortage of expensive baked goods, especially in New York City. It's not like it's unheard of to charge prices comparable to what you're charging. It's not even that rare. But there is this perception of a new food company needing to be cheap or needing to compete with a quality level that we're not really, you know, we know we're not really competing with, right? Like, we're presenting something that's of a higher quality and comes with a lot. The price covers a lot, including living wages and other things. And then I lost the train of thought about what I was going to ask you. Well, you mentioned marketing, so I wanted to pivot to talk a little bit about the approach that you've taken to marketing, which is I think really interesting in the sense that you've chosen to market your product as not just a high end product, but as like I don't know what word would you use? Is it luxury? Is it premium? But your photography is gorgeous and striking and very different from the standard approach to food photography, and especially to baked goods or to dessert photography.
Yeah. I mean, as I looked around at what I had done in the past, with my other, you know, small pastry companies that I had as a child. And then I looked around at what people were doing. It didn't feel like me. So it wasn't an intentional, we're going to be this kind of company. It was like, I wear a lot of black all the time. And I like, you know, the dark and mysterious look, like big, big Scorpio energy, as they would say. I looked around for stock photography that showed black hands, and I didn't find anything. So I started creating my own stock photography for my website. So that's just like the shots that you see on my Instagram with pecans, or just, you know, pecans in my hand, or I'm squeezing some butter, or I'm holding up a whisk with whipped cream on it. I wanted those types of shots, but I wanted them to be representative of me. And that it just kind of built, grew from there. It was completely organic in that sense. And it's just, I think that it's different. So people are attracted to it. And I hope that I can continue to just create from the heart and not try to think too much about what's going to get their attention. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's working. I mean, it really does stand out, especially, you know, Instagram especially winds up being just a parade of people taking essentially the same picture of the same food over and over and over again, made by this person or made by that person. But the styles, the camera angles, the way that things are framed are very trend based. And so to see your stuff, it really does stand out. I also wanted to ask, I know that your business has gone through some changes over the last few months, and especially related to the BLM protests and the BLM movement. And the urge, or I guess the, I don't know what, the support for Black businesses as a result. Tell us what's happened. What have the last few months been like for you?
Super exciting times. I mean, I woke up one day and I was getting all these orders and I didn't understand why. I had taken a break from Instagram, so the app wasn't even on my phone. Then I logged in and Delish had featured us, and it's just been amazing ever since, like nothing short of amazing. The outpouring of support from all types of people has been incredible. And, you know, I was just telling our good friend Korsha, that we both know, that my sales for Blondery last year are I would say we did 5 times that in 1 month. Wow. Like literally in 1 month, we made 5 times what we made in all of last year.
Amazing.
Which is like insane, but I am not complaining.
Well, so yeah, I guess that was my next question. How do you feel about that? How do you contextualize you know, the sort of conflict or contradiction between identity and like, it's, you're making the same thing, right? Like what you were selling last year is the same thing that you're selling this year. And there's always growth year over year, or there ideally is always growth for a new small business. But how do you contextualize that, the speed of that growth for you?
Well, I think that, I hope that one day we can look back at this time and remember it as the time that white people discovered that there was racism. That it'll only be funny when we get past this moment. But I think that that's what happened, is that people saw that it really is systemic. Oh my gosh. Like I feel like that was the reaction. And then I need to support, which is such a beautiful reaction. Like if your first reaction to injustice is, oh my God, how can I help? Like, that's beautiful. That's humanity, right? Like that's what we do. So, I mean, that's how I see it. I think that people are just looking to support in however they can. I've had offers from so many different people, so many different beautiful souls who want to help Blondery in numerous ways. And I think that this is just a beautiful time for everyone. And it's made everything a little more, the playing field a little more equal, because now we have as a Black brand, I now have the visibility. And I've never said I'm a Black owned business. Like that was never like one of my marketing things. Like I make really good pastries and I happen to be Black. And I'm noticing that maybe some of these people are buying right now because I am Black, but my product is actually really good too. So I'm seeing that they are return customers, and that makes me happy.
So are you worried at all that it's going to be short-lived, that this is sort of the product of a moment, and that level of support, or that the customers who are coming to you now who weren't before, that they're just going to drop off? I guess my yes. concern more broadly is that that especially for food businesses, it's really easy for a white person to like purge their guilt by buying something that ultimately is fairly inexpensive, that's consumable, that they can post about or tell their friends about and get a little credit for, but then they eat it and it's gone and they move on with their lives. Is that a concern that you not that this is a leading question or anything, but how do you feel about that?
No, yes, I definitely feel like that. But my thing is that, yes, they did order it thinking all of those things. But then their friend said, you know, this is like really good. Like, or they said to themselves, this is actually really good. I'm going to buy it again around the holiday time. So my goal right now is to grab as much market share while I have you guys' attention, so that when you try the product and you actually like it, you're a return customer. But yes, I am very concerned that this is going to go away very soon, and which sucks. But, you know, it's been a few months and it hasn't, and I thought our attention span was a lot shorter, so maybe I'm just being pessimistic. You know, it's been a few months. Yeah.
Do you have any, before we do our rapid fire segment and wrap up the interview, do you have any words of wisdom or pieces of advice to share with other people thinking about making the kind of transition and starting their own entrepreneurial journey that you did?
Yes. Get out of your own way. And I have to remind myself of that very often. And I mean that by whatever you're thinking of doing was implanted in your head for a reason. Even if it fails, you were supposed to go after and pursue it, because I guarantee you are going to learn something. And that is super cliche, but it's also super true. And that's why people say it so much, because I'm telling you from my 29 years of experience, which is not a lot, that, yeah, it's true. Like, whatever ideas you have are implanted in your head, like, by whoever you believe in. If you don't believe in anything, they're there for a reason, and you have to go out and pursue it, because you never know who you're going to meet while you're pursuing it. And then always try to give, like, try to pursue it 110%. If that means taking a job, I cleaned houses for years while I was starting Blondery. After I left the fine dining industry, I cleaned houses for 2.5, I think 3 years. I did that out of a place of, like, I wanted this. I wanted to be my own boss. I wanted to help people's lives. I wanted to employ people. And I did it. And, you know, it's I would say it's paying off now.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. Let's do some rapid fire questions. If you were a pastry, what pastry would you be?
A blondie. A cannoli, right. Actually, a cannoli.
A cannoli. I figured it was going to be a blondie. Because I really like them. What? Is there something about, like, a hard exterior and a soft? No, I'm overthinking it.
No, that's true. Yes, that's true. That's who I am. I think a lot of people, when they meet me, they're like, "Oh, she's so serious and she looks intimidating." But that's just my resting, you know what, face. I'm actually very sensitive on the inside, and I have all the feels for everyone. So, yeah, that's why I would be a cannoli.
What is your favorite kitchen tool?
My mini offset spatula.
Good answer.
I don't know why. I don't know why. I feel like I just use it all the time.
Yeah.
If it's missing, I'm like going crazy. I'm like, where is it?
I think it's one of those tools that professionals know about and home cooks don't seem to know about at all. Like, I don't know how many, I can't think of hardly anybody who has just, like, has one in their kitchen at home who hasn't worked in a professional kitchen, but they're so useful. Yeah. and they allow you to do things with a level of delicacy and precision.
Yes, exactly.
There aren't really a lot of other tools. What did you eat for lunch as a kid growing up?
Grilled cheese and barbecue, ribs.
Do you have a lot of ribs? Thoughts on barbecue or thoughts on ribs that you want to share, having grown up in that environment?
Yeah. No, I don't. No, right. I don't, actually.
Awesome. Well, Azarais, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show. I'm so glad you were able to join us this week and share your insight and wisdom and experience with me and with our audience. Where can our listeners find you and find your product?
On Instagram at Blondery. That's B as in boy, LONDERY. And we're almost at 3,000 followers, and I would love to get to 5,000 by the end of the year. I know it's super vain, but it's just a goal. So if you guys could follow me, that would be great.
And where can people buy your blondies?
Oh, you can buy them on Instagram, or you can also go to my website, which is blondery.com.
Awesome. As always, thanks to Jess Kranjich, our sound engineer. Thanks to Blind by the Red Crickets, or thanks to the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is Blind. I'm Ethan Frisch. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram. And you can find Valerie on Instagram at Foodie in New York. And most of all, thank you, Azarais.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us, and see you all next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.